This week on Dan Really Likes Wine, a man whose introduction is almost as colourful as he is himself, a former head boy of Weinberg Boys High School, and that's going back some time, I think even before Alan Lamb was there, somebody who spent time working in some of the great homes of Bordeaux and now finds himself as a largely barefoot, Santa Claus bearded, trucker capping maker of some of the great wines of South Africa. Arie Badenhorst, welcome.
Thanks, Dan. You really like wine. This wine we're going to taste is going to test that. It's going to test it properly.
Oh, well, we're going to get to it. I'm looking forward to it because if you made it, it is always going to be a delight. Let's reverse that. We find ourselves in the Swartland, just down the road from where you call home, but a little further away from where life began for Arie Badenhorst, because you kicked off in Constantia. You were I'm trying to picture you as this sort of snobbish 4x4 driving Constantia type. It's a bit of a world away from Arie today.
Listen, I mean, in Constantia those days, growing up there was quite different to what it was like a hippie commune. The guys living in Constantia, all those hippie families, they eventually sold their properties and bought like crap properties in La Dudno because nobody wanted to live in La Dudno. But there weren't traffic lights in Constantia. It was a farming community. And my father and his uncle, Fred, they farmed vegetables together. So they rented farms. And so I grew up there on a farm. My grandfather as well was farm manager at Groot Constantia. And my grandmother's father was farm manager at Eagle's Nest. So my roots were from Constantia, but we moved here to the Swartland in 2008.
But obviously a lot of wine making in the DNA, and that kicked in quite early because you were a ridiculous age when you made your first wine.
Yeah, we played around a bit in the cellar with Jean Denil. I made some Pinot Gris.
How old were you when you made that?
13 or 14, I think. Stand at 6 or 7, you know. It was terrible. It was terrible, but I had like 23 bottles that I bottled into the day and we drank it, you know, our friends. And I did have a few bottles left over until a couple of years ago. So I started playing around there. I remember visiting the winery every day after school, you know, and chatting to Jean. And then, of course, across the road, there was a wonderful guy called Ross Gower. And I used to go and hang out there as well. I think Ross sort of like, I really irritated Ross. You know, the one day we were standing outside the winery and I was chatting to Ross and he didn't speak much. And then a distance, there was a girl riding a horse. Constantia's full of horse riders. Everybody's got a little horse there. And in the distance, we saw this girl on the horse and the horse reared up and the girl fell off and we climbed into the buggy and he was going to help her. And driving there and he said, okay, on the way, he says, you get the horse, I'll get the girl. As we approached and he looked at the girl, he says, you get the girl, I'll get the horse. It's one of my earliest memories of Ross Gower and Clare Constantia. So I grew up in Constantia and it's surrounded by vineyards and wines and obviously a culture of wine drinking.
And that extended into post-school. You'd finished head boy of Weinberg, very esteemed position, but wine, I think, was always going to be the direction. And it didn't take too long to end up in Europe. And you got to work in some pretty cool spots in Europe.
No, yeah, I worked at the fanciest one was Chateau Angelus.
You know, did they have the bells at that stage?
I don't remember much about it. I mean, it was a crazy time. 17 of us living in a little house, 2 bedrooms, 1 bathroom. All the interns, a couple of South Africans. We just really, we dove deep into the French wines during our stay there and the French lifestyle. So it was a bit of a blur. I don't remember any bells ringing at any time that I was at Angelus. But I've worked in France a few times after that as well. I really enjoy visiting France and I love the culture, I love the people. And of course, the wines are extraordinary.
And it's formative, I think, not just in terms of your winemaking, your understanding thereof, but just developing you as a person and broadening that worldview.
I think it's so important that every young person travels and spends a good amount of time overseas. Try and get a fair grip on a language. I mean, I tried French. I'm useless. But it was just to submerge yourself into that culture and try and understand the way people think, why they think. And, you know, like for me, it was amazing in Saint-Emilion when there was rain predicted and it started raining, the whole town would go into depression, you know, just because everybody was concerned about the grapes and that was their livelihood. And that was amazing for me. It's not like that here in South Africa. We've got a far bigger palette to work with in South Africa. And I only realized that a little bit later once I got back here.
And getting back meant starting to work in vineyards full time. And I think Rustenburg was where you really started making a name for yourself.
Yeah.
Although it didn't always go fantastically well. Was it at Rustenburg where you got that famous score for one of your wines?
No, no, no. That was under my own label. That was when I'd left Rustenburg. When I was at Rustenburg, the wines I made were still pretty good and okay. It's when I started making wine for myself that I got that 57.
57 points out of 100.
It is the lowest scoring wine ever.
In the history of wine.
I think certainly in the Swartland, most definitely in South Africa, without a doubt in the Southern Hemisphere. And it's contending for the lowest
score. The Vietnamese wine that got 59 points a few years ago.
That kicked me out of the park. Yeah, that was for a skin fermented Hanapuit, a dry Hanapuit. So the thing was sort of unfiltered and it's drinking beautifully still to this day. There was a 2013 vintage, but 57 points. I've still got the write up.
Who was it who gave you 57 points?
A Johannesburg wine writer. It was a wine for the Cape Winemakers Guild. And I entered this wine. It was in those days you could enter wine that you put forward. It didn't go through a selection process. So I put this wine forward and it was a bit of an outcry, you know, at that time of the guild. But the wine achieved an amazing price. And it was interesting. And it just shook things up a little bit, which I think is necessary sometimes.
It could have been a bit of a reverse psychology, wanting to get the only 57-point wine ever made.
Yeah, I thought it might get like 59 or 60, but 57 was a shock.
See what I want to do for a future show. Have you still got any bottles of that?
I've got plenty.
All right. I want
to get... Not a plenty.
You got a few?
No, I've got a couple.
All right. If we can get you and that wine and the wine writer and get the three of you together.
That'll be amazing. That'll be amazing. It's almost a decade since, you know?
All right. The fences will be mended. I shall make that my mission. It's part of one of many stories of this Ardie Badenhorst legacy that you created. Before we jump into that, going back to Rustenburg, you got to come back and Rustenburg is an iconic South African property and a great part of the winemaking world. How important was that part of the Ardie Badenhorst journey?
I think it was extremely important. I mean, I love history and I love tradition. And starting at Rustenburg, by the time I was there, that was in the late 90s, 99, I started at the end of 99, there'd only been three winemakers before me since the 40s. One was the great Reg Nicholson, who retired in the mid-70s. Then Etienne Lariche. We all know Etienne Lariche made some of the greatest, most iconic Rustenburg wines of the 82, for example. And then Rod Easthope, a New Zealander, stepped in for a couple of years. And then I got the job, and I was there for 9 years. So it was extremely important for me to make good wine there, to have access to these amazing grapes, because Rustenburg is a large property. It's 1,200 hectares. Anywhere else in the world, it would have been an appellation on its own. It's a really, really unique property.
And it gave you all this great experience, and it could have given you a job for life, really, if you'd wanted it. But that wasn't you, because there is a freedom of spirit to you. And you launched into, I won't say it was a piece of con artistry, but you did manage to persuade a family member that investing in the Swartland would be a very good idea.
Yeah, look, I mean, Look, it was my great friend, Ibn Sadi, was making wines in the Swartland. When I started my journey, I was at Groenteposte for a year. That's when I met Ibn, and we'd remained friends. And then end of 2007, when I left Rustenburg, it was natural to come to the Swartland. There was no other area I was looking at. I'd bought grapes in the same valley that from where our farm is today. So I knew the area. I knew some of the people. So it was not like coming home, but I remember driving on that Jakkalsfontein Road late November, and it's hot and dusty, and coming to the small little farm school. It felt as if I'd driven 6 hours, that kind of landscape. It was a landscape that was open and humble, and textured slopes, and I immediately felt at home.
It's a part of the world that not that long ago people would have laughed at you if you'd said we're going to make fine wine here. The Swartland was not about fine wine. It was about white wine that gave you a four-day hangover and making grapes of brandy. And yet people like yourself and Ibn and the Molyneux and Cully and Mark Kent, you saw something here that other people don't. And I often liken it to a golf course designer seeing a piece of land and somehow seeing a golf course there that nobody else would.
Hell.
What was it about you guys that you saw here and just something said, this is right?
I don't know. I mean, like the first time I brought Hein, my cousin and partner, to the place, he'd never been to that part of the world, and his eyes were opened. But you know, when we arrived at the Swartland, it was Eben and myself and Chris and Andrea and Cully. We all knew each other quite well, and the timing was just perfect as well. You know, the grapes that came from Porcelainbach, Cully and I worked with those grapes. Cully and I worked together at Rustenburg Wines. We worked with those grapes. We bought those grapes for Rustenburg. So when Cully going to Porcelainbach was, I mean, he's going home. He knows these grapes. He's worked with them for a couple of years before. And of course, Chris also worked at Rustenburg with me. I didn't know Andrea at that time. She turned down a job offer at Rustenburg Wines, and she went to go work for Kevin Grant, I think. I still hold it against every now and then,
and rightfully so.
Yeah, rightfully so. but the amazing thing was that these producers coming together at the same time, more or less, in this area, because I think we all recognized the potential of this place. You know, we tasted widely. We'd seen vineyards. We'd see how they grow in the summers and the kind of quality grapes they produce. And it just made so much sense to move to the Swartland.
And you settled in and began to create what we now know as the Swartland Revolution.
Yes.
And set up. If you look back, it seems like, well, this was all very carefully planned. You knew exactly what you're doing. And this was going to become the world's new greatest wine area. Easy to say that now. I'm guessing it wasn't quite that way as it all unfolded.
No, we had no idea. And look, I mean, the big driving force behind the Swartland Revolution, a guy that's not always recognized for it, is Mark Kent, who, through his ownership of Porcelainbach, you know, suggested, why? And they came back from a hospice to bone thing in California where he met Chris and Eben, and they were one of these fancy things. And they came back with this idea. And it wasn't a... the difference between a lot of these things is if they become marketing vehicles, there's often there's not that sincerity in it. This was actually just like a producers coming together and celebrating other wines, not our own stuff, inviting amazing people to come and present their wines, wine writers, experts to come and present wines that they think maybe reminded them of the Swartland or they thought were applicable for the Swartland. And there was that kind of generosity in showcasing other producers that I think is genuine, and it still is genuine. You know, it was never like a Sardi Chenin Blanc versus the Malinu Chenin or the Bardonnay Syrah versus the Porcelainbach. None of that kind of nonsense. It was just showcasing people that we respected and people that made great wines.
And it is an extraordinary set of friendships because I've seen more than enough of you guys together. And yes, you take the mickey out of each other all the time and there's a great lot of banter between you all. But there's genuine love in this particular part of the world for each other, for each other's wines. And you also genuinely revel in each other's success, which is not always the case.
Yeah, but it's natural, you know, it's come naturally. And that spread, not just from the revolution, it's spread now to a lot of other producers in the Swartland. There's a unity here and understanding and that you don't find anywhere else in the world. Nowhere else in the world. There are no secrets here. We know that you're going to be speaking later to maybe Saki and Donovan and Cully. You're going to try and get some words out of Cully. Chris and Andrea can speak. But you'll see there's like an openness of spirit here. There's no secrets. We're all trying to make a living on a piece of land. We're trying to sell, you know, fermented grape juice in a bottle. I mean, we're trying to sell that and trying to sell a part of this place. That's what it is.
I would counsel that you're not just selling that. You're also selling great stories, and you have these great stories to tell. And that's a big part of why the Swartland has become what it has. And if I look at visits to Bardenhorst HQ in particular, where it probably would get closed down by the health authorities, I've had a proper look at what you've got stuffed in glass bottles in your office and dead animals hanging from the roof. And it looks like you've got some kind of outdoorsman in the back end of Arkansas who's shored up in a wine cellar. But in between all of the the madness and the color, you've got this space where the music's always playing, your love of vinyl enhances it. And it's far more for me than just a winemaking space. It's a real hub of creativity and of life and of energy and so many of your passions weaving around the wine itself.
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't want to be defined by a wine. That'd be my worst nightmare, is to be defined by one wine or one vintage. So Kalmoesfontein, what you're saying, it's become a gathering place for the whole district. You know, there's ceramic artists there, there's people making wine, and I don't know, just exploring their creativity. There's venues, and every Thursday night, the pizza night. I mean, you know, life, you've got your friends, and you've got your family. In the old days, a lot of people used to go to church. But Kalmoesfontein on Thursday night has become the new church. It's become a place where you can gather. You don't get judged. You get preached a different kind of gospel, and that's a gospel of just like togetherness and being nice and sharing bottles of wine and over great pizzas together. And that's really important for us to have that.
I remember seeing you at an event in Cape Town, and I'd asked you, "Yeah, how are you doing?" And you were a little bit upset, because the night before you'd had your pizza night and it hadn't gone as planned. And I asked what that meant. He said, "No, most of the guys have gone home by 2 o'clock in the morning. You had nobody left to play with."
No, I've taken a back seat lately for the pizza nights. But yeah, a Friday is a long, long day. It's a long day after a pizza night. But that's the thing. So on the farm next door, Jakkalsfontein, we're going to like create a similar kind of space, you know, for people. You know, maybe guys making amazing tables or artists and have that kind of vibe going on there and that kind of energy, because it's more than just wine.
Tell me in particular about the music, because you've got the vinyl going. Yes. I've been into the cellar a number of times. It's a collection of music. Some of it in my book is dreadful.
Yes,
some of it is amazing, but it's such a wide range. You'll be playing reggae one day and it's a bit of hard rock the next day, and then you're meandering into some jazz.
Yeah.
And I think it speaks quite nicely to your wine, because you've got such a wide array of style and interpretation within the broader Swartland palette that you give us from your wine. And similarly, the music comes from all over the place.
Yeah, well, we make too many wines. You're right. We make too many wines, too many things. No, the music I love. I mean, some of the guys have been going to jazz concerts lately, so there's a lot of jazz in the cell at the moment over the last 2 weeks. But we listen to anything. The first vinyl I bought as a 13-year-old was Bob Dylan Infidels and Rodriguez Cold Fact. And I've still got those albums in the cell, and we play them often, like really, really amazing. But I love the music. I don't always, I'm not musical by any sense. I can't hold a note. I can't sing. I've got no rhythm, but I do love music. And yeah, it's important to play music. Little vinyl thing up in my house as well, and there's a few records there, and we interchange them between the winery and my house. And yeah.
It makes your cellar so alive. And I genuinely...
Well, our vinyl player is actually our lab. That's where we do the quality control.
Inspiration center. And I definitely think it reflects in the wine. And that's what we're going to move into, because you spent a lot of time carefully choosing the wine to bring with you.
I did.
For us to drink today.
I did. I looked at one of the great vintages of the last decade, and it was 2017. And luckily, Chris Molyneux had some bottles here as well. I just drink out of this out of Magnums these days. But this is 2017 Kalmoesfontein Red. This is an amazing wine to put together for us. It's really pushed our boundaries in terms of, you know, picking dates, maturation, extraction, et cetera, et cetera. It's one of the few red blends that's everything is harvested on the same day. Every single parcel, there's 9 parcels in there, 4 or 5 varietals, but picked on the same day. In the past, we used to ferment them separately and keep some barrels of Shiraz there and some Cinsault and some Grenache and some Tinta Barocca. And then at the end of the year, we'll come and tasting the taste like some of the Grenaches. Test, that's a nice, and kick that barrel aside and then make up the blend that we thought was the best. But always guaranteed, the same with the white blend. Guaranteed, a couple of months later, 4 or 5 months later, you go back to that barrel you excluded in November or December, and that thing is just amazing.
Yeah.
And at that time, it just wasn't perfect according to our perceptions. So in order to eliminate that human error, we started picking everything together.
And that allowed...
Like one decision.
It. And very much, I think, like a lot of the music you play in your cellar, it's got all of those different elements coming together. And on its own, that that bass guitar or that cello or the triangle, which I feel is a much maligned instrument in many bands today,
100%,
yeah, might be a little underwhelming, but somehow, and you'll see a blend sometimes, it's got 1 or 2% in it, and you go, oh, why bother? And yet it is that little note of the triangle in the chorus.
Especially as these wines age. You know, in the beginning, they you know, when you blend different components, you can pick out the individuals in tasting the wine and smelling it. But like this is like an arranged marriage, you know. It's like a guy from the north of Italy kicking the ball before the whistle blew with a girl in the south. The priest is going to marry them on 5 o'clock on a Friday morning, and they're going to look quite, but, you know, they're going to go on and they're going to have 4 or 5 children. They're going to travel the world. And this is this kind of wine. It really, really gets better and better as it matures. So 2017, great vintage, but this wine is still very young. I'll be drinking this wine probably for myself in the next 4 to 5 years. And that's a problem, you know, because we want wines that we can drink on release, you know. You know, you're like, you give this wine to God. So, because we don't mature the wine at our place. I've got like the cash flow to store the wine. So as soon as the vintage is sold, we start selling. And guys say, oh, it's like it's quite a bit of tannin. And I said, yeah, but, you know, remember, it's Shiraz. It's Syrah is a grape with unashamed amount of tannin. And there's tint of Barocco in here as well. But this wine just needs a bit of time. And that's why I love drinking older wines like this.
The arranged marriage analogy is brilliant. My parents in law are in arranged marriage and they're 51 years together this year.
100%.
No more perfect cut.
No, it's 100%. But, yeah, and it also, you know, when you have to pick like this, you have to, you know, to get a ripeness, you know, because you don't want to pick something that's 12% alcohol. Then it lacks love, honestly. Like a Swartland Red Blend at 12%, geez, you know, you get all kinds of fevers. You get like malaria, you get tick fever, you get harvest fever, but there's no pill for harvest fever, you know? So you need to pick this when there's an element of ripeness. And some of the grapes are really ripe, some are less ripe, but it is a lot of intuition involved and understanding of the vineyards, you know? That's why this wine is so lacking and so nerve-wracking to make a picking date on this. And then we just like candles of the new Pope under the Pope Bob. You know, under the tank and hope for the best, you know.
He looks like the kind of guy who would enjoy a glass of wine, and
I think he will. I think
we should send a case of this to the Vatican from the Pope of Swat.
So we bottled. I mean, I was going to post it on social media, but so we bottled our new Secateur Chenin Blanc, the 25 vintage, on that just after Easter weekend. So the Pope passed away on Easter Monday, and we bottled the new Secateur's Chenin Blanc 2025 on the Tuesday morning. And I was going to post something instead of like in the bottle while the old man is still warm or something like that. I think it probably would not have gone down well.
I think you might have had some interesting feedback.
That's why I've got media consultants like you to advise.
There is, much like the person who made it, so much youthfulness to this wine, even though it's now 8 years old, which leads me to try and work out, as the resident DJ of the Greater Swartland, what we would be playing to drink this with. And I'm drawn to somebody like, I'm not sure what he called himself at the end, but Prince, the artist formerly known as Symbol, Frank, whatever he was calling himself by the end of it, somebody who was eternally youthful.
So that's a very, very good question.
David Bowie, one of these guys who never seems to age.
So what we always say, like, about, like, Jasper and I, Jasper Wickens worked for many years, and, like, all the bands, but we always came back to Led Zeppelin. The way they produced the albums and put it together. Every other band since Led Zeppelin was just taking little bites out of the corpse of Led Zeppelin. But I must actually think of something, a little Led Zeppelin number for this.
Well, you went and arranged marriage, which suggests manufactured pop band, which suggests this is the Spice Girls of Swartland wine. And it's got a bit of spice to it. I think that's brilliant. I can see Jerry Halliwell in full cry with a glass of 2017 Kolmogorsfontein.
He's like on the finish, it's that Bob Dylan, that sandpaper and blue finish, that kind of voice, you know?
Oh, dear. It is a joy to drink, as it is a joy to spend time with you. And it's a joy to spend a bit of time with your family as well, which I've got to do in small doses. I've had your wife shout at me numerous times.
Did you deserve it? Probably not.
Oh, no. She did, in fairness, apologize and gave me a very, very nice spittoon.
Oh, did she?
I'm not sure what I'm going to use it for because we don't use spittoons in our house. But it was very nice. It's
probably one of my favorite vases at home.
But the other question I've got to meet is somebody who you are in serious jeopardy of falling behind in the pecking order in terms of Badenhorst celebrities, because he's got a pretty exciting rugby career ahead of him if he plays his cards right.
Oh, Samuel. Yes. Yeah. Now, he enjoys a bit of rugby.
Stellenbosch first team centre.
Yeah, he's been playing recently now for the Western Province under 21s. I think he's going to play under 19s now again. But yeah, no, he's lying at home as we speak. He's just getting out of bed. But yeah, no, he loves the rugby. But he'll one day be working for his sister if he ever comes back to the farm. So Anna is probably, you know, she's quite driven.
Well, that's where I wanted to go with this, because there's a family legacy to the property. You and your cousin kicking it off. Your wife really does run things.
She does.
And, most of the Swartland reports into her. But you...
Yeah, when she's finished with the Swartland, she's going to focus on the town of Malmesbury and then sort out all the towns.
You're a decade and we're all good. But has that succession plan been part of a conversation? Do you ideally see the kids stepping into where you are and this becomes a generational space?
Yeah, I would love to see that. So I and my partner, his daughter, Amelia, and Samuel are classmates at Elsenburg, both studying winemaking, which is fantastic. And the two younger ones on Hein's side and my side are still at school, grade 10. But it'll be amazing if they could step in. Because we do a lot of stuff, our dad, on the farm. You know, we make the vermouth, we're doing sherries, brandy, you know, the tequila spirits. There's a lot of stuff happening there. So there's a lot of space for people to come in, family members. Like, so it was my daughter said the other day, I said to Samuel, are you a Nepo kid? But, you know, that it would be great if they could step in.
I suspect they will, because the combined genetics of their mother and their father make for a formidable combination.
Yeah, but also, you know, they've got to see you having fun and enjoying your work. You know, you can't force them into weekend working, like waxing bottles and whipping them with little
shots. I disagree entirely.
To a certain age.
My children are out of school at 8 and 10 and working in a factory to pay their way by this age. Oh, dear. Adi, many great adventures already. I look forward to many more. Thank you, though, not just for being on the show, but for a great and blossoming friendship. And also for giving not just fabulous wine to South Africa, but so much character and life and excitement and joy, because it translates into everything you do, including the wine. And at the risk of sounding a little left of center, and kind of like my sister-in-law, who's often up in the clouds, there is something... spiritual is maybe too strong a word, but there really is the sense of who you are that comes across in your wine, and that's what makes it really special.
Right, and thanks very much, and thanks for your time as well, and all the work you've done here in the Swartland, and to many more passive encounters with my wife in the future. Cheers.
I cannot wait. Adi Badenhorst, the head boy of Weinberg made good, is now one of the kings of the Swartlands.